Now, something quite new entered with Christianity into the development of the world conceptions of the West. The rational thinking was pushed into the shadows by a quite different authority, by that of revelation. It assumed that truth doesn't emanate from thinking, but the truth emanates from a higher force. A higher force which reveals the truth to the human being. This, furthermore, becomes the actual conviction. It is the belief in facts of a super-earthly significance, and the unbelief in reference to reason that constitutes the nature of Christianity. The people who belong to the Christian teaching did not want to believe in their thinking. They wanted to believe in such sensual events which the senses experienced, through which the truth was supposed to be revealed. And we quote, "That which from the very beginning had occurred, what we have heard, what our eyes have seen, what we ourselves have perceived, what our hands have touched of the word of life, that which we have seen and heard, this is what we announce to you in order that you should have community with us." This is quoted from the first epistle of John. And Augustine says, "I would not believe the gospel if the authority of the Catholic Church did not impel me to believe the gospel. That which the contemporaries of Christ have seen and have heard, that which the church has preserved as things that have been heard and seen through tradition, now that is what becomes truth. No more should be valid as truth that which man reaches through his thinking, but only which he has experienced through his senses, insofar as those senses report from eyewitnesses and people who have heard of all the things that happened at the beginning of Christianity with the birth, death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Christianity, we confront on the one side the religious thought world of the Jews, and on the other side, the ideas of the Greek world conception. The religion of Judaism was originally a national, egotistical religion. God had selected his people and has chosen them for earthly power and rulership. However, this folk had to experience the most bitter disappointments and disillusionments. It was taken in captivity and made subject to other people. The hope of the Messiah, that proceeded from the fact that it expected a redemption out of its misery, that its God would ultimately redeem it from its misery. They ascribed the degradation to which they had experienced as the result of their own sinfulness. And here there penetrate ideas of a turning away from life, from that life which has led to sinfulness. One should not attach oneself to this life which indeed leads to sin, but one should rather more turn to God, who would soon bring his kingdom upon the earth and will free human beings out of their misery. Jesus was quite filled with such ideas. He wanted to speak to the poor and those who were oppressed, not to those who attach themselves to the treasures of this life. The heavenly kingdom, which was soon to come, will belong to those who previously had lived in misery. and Jesus represented that the kingdom of heaven was shortly about to approach. Jesus did not point people to a beyond, but he pointed to them that in the realm of time, and actually quite soon, the Lord would come and would bring man splendor and glory. However, already through Paul, and still more through the teachers of the first Christian centuries, there was replaced, instead of the naive faith, it was replaced by a connection, a uniting of the teaching of Christ with the ideas of the later Greek philosophers. And so that heavenly kingdom, which was about to approach in the realm of time very quickly, that was transformed, the heavenly kingdom was transformed to the beyond. The Christian faith was transformed with the help of the Greek world conception thoughts. Out of this reinterpretation, out of this working together of the original naive ideas, combining the original ideas with the traditional conceptions, they developed in the course of time the dogmatic content of the Christian teaching. And thought entered completely into the service of faith. Thought was the servant of revelation. The whole of the Middle Ages worked towards the point of supporting the revelation with the help of thinking. Just as in the first centuries, thinking and revelation worked one into the other. This is demonstrated by the church father Augustine, 354 to 430 AD. This occurred in a later time in the church with Thomas of Aquinas, 1227 to 1274. This is what Augustine said. Even if we have all sorts of doubts, one fact remains still maintaining itself, that the thinking man himself must be there. Otherwise, indeed, he could not doubt. When I doubt, so am I in the process of thinking. Hence I exist. Hence my reason is there. And in the reason, there reveals itself to me in reason certain truths. But my reason never can cognize all truth, complete truth. But my reason can cognize always only single truths. These single truths, however, can originate only from that being who contains within himself all truth, namely from God. Thus there must exist a divine beingness. My reason proves that to me. However, my reason provides me only with a part of the truth. But in revelation, there exists the highest truth. This is what the sort of presentation that Augustine had. Now, Thomas Aquinas is a much more comprehensive thinker who had worked over the whole knowledge of his age in an astonishing, sharp way. You ought not to believe that this Christian philosopher confronted the knowledge of nature and that of reason in an antagonistic way. No. Nature was for him the one source of truth. Another source of truth was revelation. According to his opinion, from the Godhead there emanates everything which exists in the world. Also, the phenomena of nature are an outflow of the divine beingness. When we investigate the world of nature, so we are investigating with our thinking into the deeds of the God. However, with our weak human thinking, we cannot press forward to the highest deeds of the Godhead. According to Thomas Aquinas, we indeed can prove still out of our reason that a God does exist. However, in reference to the nature of God, the nature of his three-in-oneness, about the redemption of mankind through Christ, about the might of the sacraments, etc., all those we can experience nothing by using our reason. About that, we are instructed from the revelation which has been maintained through the authority of the Church. The situation is not that these higher things cannot be reached with reason, Thomas believes, but man cannot reach these higher things through his thinking for the reason, because only the human reason is too weak. It's not the reason itself that cannot contact these higher realms, but human reason is undeveloped, is too weak to contact these higher truths, which have to be accepted by the revelation through the authority of the Church. However, a much stronger reason would also be able to understand and take hold of the revealed truths. And this is a sort of perception which was represented itself in the scholasticism of the Middle Ages. Now, a different path from the scholastics was pursued by the German mysticism, the German mystics who attempted to reach the realm of truth. The most important mystics are Meister Eckhart, who died in 1327, Johannes Tauler, who died in 1361, Heinrich Zuse, who died in 1365, Paracelsus, 1493 to 1541, Jakob Boehmer, 1575 to 1624, and Angelus Silesius, 1624 to 1677. All these mystics represent themselves really as predecessors of the modern world conception, since they did not proceed from an external authority, but they wanted to seek the truth within the soul of man and within the phenomena of nature. It is not an external Christ, according to their opinion, which can show man the way to his goal, but it is solely the spiritual forces within the human inner being who can show man the way to his goals. Paracelsus emphasized that the physician must take his examination through the realm of nature. Paracelsus said this in order to point to the fact that we shall find in nature itself the source of truth. And Angelus Silesius emphasized that the divine beingness does not exist outside the things of nature, but God exists within the realm of nature. The fact that nature itself is the divine and creates as a divine aspect, that he expresses in his beautiful sentences, as for example, I know that without me, God could not live for a minute. If I eliminated my existence, then God of necessity would have to give up his existence. God has no other life other than within things. God has his existence not external to things but inside things. Of such a conception also dominates the world conception of Jacob Boehmer. Now, with the scholastics, it is easily seen, it is realizable, that the scholasticism was all continuously strived to represent and to produce a harmony between reason and revelation. And this did not occur without a sort of over-refined logic. It didn't occur without a sort of hair-splitting, captious type of drawing of conclusions. The mystics wanted to completely free themselves from such sophisticating thinking. The mystics maintained that the highest thing, the highest which the human being can cognize, it's impossible to find that highest through this logic chopping sharpness of thinking. But to get the highest, the person must realize that this highest realm can be reached directly by immersing oneself in the world of nature and in the human, within the human soul. Now, Luther proceeded from similar impressions. As far as he was concerned, he was not so much interested in what the mystics were doing, but what he wanted to do, above all, he wanted to save the divine revelation above all from the contradictions of reason. And now, in contrast to the scholastics, he wanted to reach the divine revelation insofar as he maintained the following proposition. He maintained that reason has nothing whatsoever to do in the evaluation of the facts of faith. Reason should restrict itself solely to the explanation of the world phenomena, but reason has nothing to do with the truths of faith and revelation. The revealed word, that is a source of faith, and with this faith, reason has nothing at all in common. Reason is not concerned with this source of faith. Reason can neither refute the faith, nor can it prove the faith. The faith stands fast for itself. Reason tries to penetrate and deal with religious truths. All you get is a vain quarreling, wrangling, and squabbling, and all sorts of geschwätz. For this reason, Luther despised Aristotle, that very Aristotle upon whose teachings the scholastics supported themselves. These scholastics who tried to maintain faith on the basis of reason. Luther said the following. He said, this God-cursed Aristotle is a real devil, a real devil. He is a denier. He is a terrible sycophant. a prince of darkness, a beast, an ugly deceiver of mankind, devoid of all philosophy. He is an open and recognized liar, a wanton buck. That's what Luther thought of Aristotle. Now you can see what we're dealing with here. Aristotle actually wanted to reach the highest truths through human thinking. Luther wanted to defend these highest truths against the working over of reason. Hence, he called the reason the whore of the devil. Reason which could do nothing else but to make shame of that which God speaks and does. Now these ideas of Luther still remain today in the church, even if modern theology tries to surround them with a cloak. In Adolf Harnack, we read the following: science is not able to give a meaning to life. Religion, namely the love of God and man, that's what gives life a sense. The greatness of Jesus is actually that he led man back to God. The Christian religion is eternal life within the time aspect. It just happened that shortly after Luther's appearance, this reason, which was despised so much by him, this reason was able to achieve one victory after the other. Copernicus, 1473 to 1543, placed his new conception of the movement of heavenly bodies. Kepler, 1571 to 1630, established the laws around which the planet moves around the sun. Galileo, 1564 to 1642, directed his telescope right into the heavenly space and was able to reveal a fullness of facts. Through such researches and advances, natural science acquired new trust to itself, and reason acquired new trust. Galileo reproduced the impressions which were established themselves in a thinker of that particular time. No longer did one believe of working in the sense of Aristotle if you held fast to that which he maintained with his limited knowledge. This is what the Middle Ages did. Now the opinion was that one could create in the spirit of Aristotle when one did just as he did, direct one's glance into the world of nature. In this direction, there were golden words which Galileo spoke when he said, "You talk always about your Aristotle who can't reply to you. However, I tell you, if Aristotle were really here, he would either be convinced by us, or he would refute our reasons in order to replace those reasons by better reasons. The philosophy is written in this greatest book, the book which is continuously open before our eyes, namely that of the universe. The universe which you cannot understand unless you previously are able to learn to understand its language and its signs." Giordano Bruno, 1548 to 1600, is one of those individuals who was in this blossoming thinking in a position to build up a world explanation in the sense of nature perception. However, beside that, side by side with that, he maintained completely with the traditional dogmas, without trying to find out or realizing how one could really be compatible with the other. Now, if human thinking did not want to deny itself, if it did not want to permit itself to be pushed into completely subordinate position, so it could do this in a new way by again trying to tread the path, that path which had been sought for along the Greek world conceptions, namely that the human thinking out of itself should attempt to press forward to the highest truths. And René Descartes, Cartesius, 1596 to 1650, he was one of the first who made an attempt. Descartes' path had much similarity with that of Augustine. Also, Descartes proceeded from the doubt upon all truth. And also he said the following, "If I also are able to doubt about all things, one thing I cannot doubt about, namely that I am, it is I who am doubting. I think when I doubt. If I did not think, so I would not be able to doubt. However, when I think, so am I. I think, therefore I am. Cogito, ergo sum." This is the well-known proposition of Descartes. And from this fundamental truth, Descartes sought to rise up to the higher knowledges. He said to himself, "That which I so clearly realize as insofar as I am myself, things like that must also be likewise true. But now there entered with him a very remarkable phenomenon. The Christian ideas of God, the soul, and immortality, which had been impressed for centuries education in Western man, he believed to find in those, in his reason, like just as secure truths as the truth that I am, I think, therefore I am." He felt he could establish those truths of God, the soul, and immortality with just as much certainty as he knew I am I. You find with Descartes even the old concept of the soul. He conceives the soul as an independent spiritual being which only utilizes the body. We have already confronted such an idea with Aristotle. Animals, according to Descartes, have nothing of a soul. They are automaton. Man has a soul which has its place in the brain, and which through the soul which sits in the brain and enters into reaction with the soulless body by means of the pineal gland. We see with Descartes a striving which is also present in the scholastics, namely to use reason to prove the ancient highest truths passed down through tradition. The only difference is that the scholastics openly admitted it. That's what they wanted. Whereas Descartes believed to be able to create all truths out of reason. Thus, Descartes proved, apparently out of reason, that which emanates only out of religion. The soul, through the fact that he made this soul into a kind of independent animated being. This doesn't arise, neither does it disappear, go away. He saved the concept of God through the fact that he ascribed to God the property of bringing all beings into a harmonious interworking. And so you get again the ancient religious concepts as truths of supposed truths of reason. This is also the case with Wolff. He distinguishes between sense truths which can be acquired through observation and higher truths which are created only out of reason itself. These higher truths are nothing other than the old truths of revelation achieved through a sort of sifting and mutilation. It's no wonder that the reason in trying to prove such sort of truths was resting itself upon very questionable concepts which could not maintain themselves against more closer critical testing. And such a critical testing of the way of truthing, of the path of truth of human reason, was taken by the English thinker Locke, 1632 to 1704, David Hume, 1711 to 1776, and by the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804. Locke tested the human capacity of knowledge and believed to find that we could arrive at knowledge only through the observation of the process of nature. Hume now asked what kind these knowledges are. He said to himself, if today I observe that the warming of a soul, a warming of a stone, is the result of the sun warmth, do I have any right to say that that always would be the same? If I have a perceive a cause and then an effect, am I permitted to say that every cause of necessity would have the same effect? No, I'm not permitted to do that. All I see is a stone falling to the earth, and I perceive that this stone makes a hole in the earth. That must be, that it could be nothing other than that, I cannot at all maintain. I see certain processes, and I accustom myself to see that they are accompanied by certain definite connections. But if such a connection really exists, if there do exist natural laws which are able to say something real about the connections of things, of that I do not know. Now Kant, who had lived in the concepts of the Wolff world conception right to his maturity, was shattered in all his convictions when he learned about the writings of Hume. The fact that reason could prove the eternal truths, up to that point he never doubted that fact, because Hume had demonstrated that even the most simple truths did not really involve some sort of proof, but everything which we believe merely and only out of habit patterns, out of custom. And Kant asked himself, is it possible that there do not exist any eternal truths? No, it can't be so. There must be such things as eternal truths. You can't doubt the truths, for example, of mathematics are always must always be necessarily true. Just as equally, you can't doubt about the fact that every effect must have a cause. But Hume convinced him that these True, these knowledges could not be eternally true if they have been won from the external out of observation. Because observation can say to us only what always has been in the past. But observation cannot always tell us if these things will always be the same. This was a conundrum for him. And so Alt Kant found a way out of this. He said, it doesn't at all depend upon the things of nature themselves, how they appear to us. How they appear to us depends solely and simply upon ourselves alone. I am so organized that for me, 2 times 2 equals 4. I am so organized that for me, every effect must have a cause. All these things are for me, but what the thing in itself is outside me, that I can never know. As if I am equipped with blue glasses. Things outside can have any sort of color, but as far as I'm concerned, they appear to me with a blue color tone. Thus all I know is how they appear to me. However, since the fact that God, immortality, and the freedom of the human will in the main are not able to be observed, so can the human reason not do very much about these things. The reason cannot concern themselves with these things. But we know, however, that man does concern himself with these things. You cannot grasp their existence. You have to believe in their existence. I know that I have to do my duty. A categorical imperative speaks in me, you should do this. Hence, because the categorical imperative says, yes, you ought to do this, so I ought to be able to do it. At least, I ought to believe in the fact that I could do it. To this belief, I need another belief. I myself cannot give the direction, the accomplishments of my duty, the necessary emphasis. I cannot so organize the world in such a way that it corresponds to that which I must regard as a necessary ethical world order. Therefore, there must exist a God who determines this ethical world order. He also gives my soul the immortality in order that in eternal life I will be able to enjoy the fruits of its duty. Fruits which are never given to it in this transient, imperfect life. And so you can see in Kant there emerges as faith and belief something which knowledge can never reach. Kant reached upon a different path, the same thing which Luther strived for upon his path. Luther wanted to exclude knowledge from the object of faith. Kant wanted the same thing. His belief is no longer the Bible belief. He speaks of a religion within the limits of pure reason. But knowledge should restrict itself only to phenomena. Knowledge, erkenntnis, knowledge should not have to do anything with the objects of faith. And so Kant correctly has been called the philosopher of Protestantism. He said, I had to remove knowledge in order to find a place for faith. Knowledge, according to the sense of Kant, has to do only with the subordinate world, that subordinate world which gives life no meaning. But that which does give life a meaning are the object of faith, into which knowledge cannot penetrate. The philosophy of the 19th century stands in many of its streams under the influence of the Kantian thoughts. Natural science at its best can provide only a subordinate wisdom. Through Kant, whom one can designate as the great reformer of philosophy, once and for all it has been proven that knowledge is limited, knowledge is subordinate, that knowledge cannot give life any sense. The world conceptions of our present time, which rest upon such self-mutilation of knowledge, have not yet arrived to the standpoint of scholastics, who at least felt themselves obligated to try to find some sort of harmony between knowledge and faith. This sort of standpoint is manifested by Du Boisrimond in his famous lecture given in the year 1872, entitled The Limits of Nature Knowledge. Now, another stream of world conception, reaching right up to the present time, takes its starting point from Spinoza, 1632 to 1677. Spinoza is a thinking who has an unconditioned trust in human reason. Things of the world stand in such a necessary connection with each other as the members of an equation or mathematical figuring. Everything of a spiritual nature, just as everything of a corporeal nature, is dominated by such necessary laws of nature. Child idea to believe that things are that the providence of nature, the all-wise providence of nature, has a similar to a human thinking. The acts of living beings, the acts of the human spirit, are subject likewise to natural laws as the stone which falls to earth according to the laws of gravity. Never to believe that a creative force creates beings according to definite goals. You fool yourself when you believe that a creator gave horns to the animal in order that it can stoss. No, the animal has received its horns according to the same necessary laws as a billiard ball continues to roll according to laws after it's impacted. The result of the necessities of nature, the animal gets horns, and because he has the horns, hence he pushes with the horns. And also say that the bull doesn't have horns in order that he can push, but he pushes, he stößt, because he has horns. According to Spinoza, God is nothing other than that indwelling natural necessity which lives in all bodily and spiritual phenomena. When man looks out into the world, then he's looking out at God. If he contemplates about things and processes, then he is representing to himself the divine world order, which is nothing other than the natural order of things. In the sense of Spinoza, you can't speak of a conflict between faith and knowledge. Of course, nothing else exists but nature. Man himself belongs to this nature. Goethe, 1749 to 1832, was also permeated by this world conception. Goethe, nature is God, and nature also reveals God. There exists no other revelation. And there cannot exist but the side of the beings of nature anything else which is supposed to be reached only through faith. For that reason, Goethe never wanted to have anything to do with Kant's distinction between faith and knowledge. 19th century thinkers were trying to build up a world conception out of the knowledge of natural science. Example, Haeckel is of the opinion that the natural laws which one investigates are not merely subordinate things, but they truly represent something which gives life a sense and a meaning. Johann Gottlieb Fichte, 1762 to 1842, places the human ego itself at the center point of his considerations. Schelling, 1775 to 1854, then further developed Fichte's ideas. Schelling said that we are able to observe the world from two sides, from the external side when we consider bodily processes, and from the inner side when we consider the spirit, that spirit which is nothing other than nature. Hegel, 1770 to 1831, went a step further. Hegel maintained, he says, in me myself that are present as concepts and ideas, the same beingness which rules the world as the eternal laws of all existence. If I look into myself, I can perceive concepts and ideas. If I look outside of myself, so these concepts and ideas are laws of nature. And so in the single human being that reflects itself as thought, that which dominates the whole world is law. He misunderstands Hegel when you assert that Hegel wanted to spin the whole world out of the idea, out of the human head. This is a great shame attributed to German philosophy that it so misunderstood Hegel. The person who understands Hegel doesn't occur to him to want to spin something out of the idea. Marx really understood Hegel in the fruitful sense of the word. Hence, Marx had looked for the economic development in that place alone where it could be found. Paulus makes a note, he says, this statement of Steiner doesn't at all mean that Steiner became an adherent of Marxism. See his three lectures, Spiritual Science and the Social Question, in the year 1905 or 1906, and also the Fundamental Points of the Social Question in 1919. When the question was asked, where are the laws to be found? On this question, Hegel answered, the laws are to be found there where the facts are also the laws. There doesn't exist ever an idea other than where the facts are, which one wants to get hold of through this idea. The person who really does researching into the facts of real life, that person is thinking in an Hegelian way, because Hegel had the viewpoint that it is not abstract thoughts but things themselves which lead to their essential nature. Likewise, you can say that modern natural science proceeds in the spirit of Hegel. Modern natural science, whose greatest founder, Charles Darwin, his work 1859, The Origin of the Species, he looks for nature laws in the realm of living beings, in likewise as he looks in the laws of lifeless nature. Ernst Haeckel puts together this idea of natural science in the following words. He says, the magnet which attracts iron filings, the powder which explodes, the steam which pushes locomotives, they work likewise through a living force, just as man who thinks. Natural science is convinced about the fact that with the laws which can be fetched out of things through reason, at the same time the essential nature of things can be revealed. All these natural scientists want to investigate nature in order out of nature itself to acquire an understanding of the sense and meaning of life. The answer can be given as Goethe gave it. The spirit is in the world of nature. Ludwig Feuerbach, 1804-1872, maintained that what man is in himself, that he deposits out in the world and then reverences it to God. So also man makes this with his ethical world order. Imagines that this is placed in himself by another higher being. In a much more radical way, Max Stirner, 1806-1856. Stirner demands that man frees himself from such specters. And the way which man can free himself from such specters can alone be obtained from a world conception built up on the basis of natural science. Other world conceptions, like that of Arthur Schopenhauer, 1788-1860, and that of Edward von Hartmann, born 1842, again are falling back into antiquated ideas. Schopenhauer made, instead of the whole human ego, he made a part of the human ego, the will, as the divine being. And Hartmann did the same thing with the ego after he had first developed the ego out of this consciousness. And hence Hartmann arrived at the unconscious as the primal ground of the world. It is very understandable that both these thinkers had to come out of their presuppositions. They had to come to the conviction that the world is the worst, most thinkable world, because they have made the ego as the primal ground of the world after they have eliminated out of this ego the rational aspect. The earlier thinkers first idealized this ego and equipped it with the reason. And so the world became an organization of infinite wisdom. The truly modern world conception can no longer take up into itself the old religious ideas. Man is built up out of nature according to eternal iron laws. All ideas which represent nature as ensouled or filled with spirit are falling back into the ancient theological ideas. Thinking can form itself a conception, a perception of this spirit which has arisen within the world of nature. And such a conception can only speak of real freedom. And this I've put down in my book, The Philosophy of Freiheit, Berlin, 1894, in my book, World and Life Conception in the 19th Century. A spirit which has been developed out of another spirit must receive also its ethical goals and aims from this other spirit, which you can designate as a cosmic spirit. A spirit, however, which originates out of the world of nature, puts for itself its own goals and aims for its existence. It provides for itself its own destination. A true philosophy of freedom cannot speak in the way in which Adolf Harnack speaks when he says that the knowledge of life is not possible to give a meaning and sense. A true free philosophy of free height shows rather more that man has arisen through the necessity of nature, that he, to be sure, has not received a previously determined sense, but it lies within him himself to give it a sense. The old world conceptions stand with these old economic orderings, and also they will fall away as the economic ordering will fall away. The man who has economically freed himself will also be a free person as a knowledge person and as an ethical moral person. And if the economic order would be able to bring all human beings a human an existence worthy of human dignity, then it will make for itself a world conception which frees the spirit. It ends the lecture, and also we can point out that in 1919, in order to satisfy this new economic order, Rudolf Steiner attacked Marxism, and as a counter to Marxism, he created his threefold commonwealth, the threefold social ordering, which alone can give man that freedom from the economic pressure, a freedom which will permit him to really develop his spirit and achieve a real freedom.